I just think there's a great many women in this gathering today that could compete for standing with the wife of excellence, but your wife absolutely is in that circle. I agree with your assessment of those things. So. Well, we are at the end of Proverbs, and this is probably, there's some verses in Proverbs that are well known, but I think as a chapter, this is probably the best known chapter in the book. And it is often treated as a text that would be taught at a women's retreat or a gathering of women or whatever. And that's probably has, you know, it's good that that happens, I suppose. But I think the vision of a woman influencing a man is, and kind of the need for men and women to contribute to each other is the most helpful thing about this text to me. Maybe the first statement or a first statement to make is that men and women aren't particularly different in the essential things. There are important reasons why we are either male or female and joined together as male and female. But in a great many of the what makes life worth living, whether it's our prayers, whether it's our ministry, whether it's our love for one another, whether it's lessons of humility, the gifts of the Spirit, the fruit of the Spirit, all of those things, we're not so different. So this text will have usefulness for everybody. But again, the thing that strikes me about it is it's not just for a woman speaking for women. It's a man speaking about the lessons his mother taught him. And what how dependent he is on the good word of that woman and other women in his life to be worthwhile as a man. That we, neither of us, men or women, do well apart from the other contributing to it, to who we are. So Proverbs 31, the last chapter of the book. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. Start out there before we actually get to the oracle. King Lemuel is not known to be anywhere else in the Bible. We don't have his lineage. We don't have his any account of where he came from, or who his parents were, or what tribe he was from, and what place he was from. He's a bit like in Genesis, early in the story of Abraham. You remember there were kings, city-states that had kings that did battle with one another. And the world was filled with small kingdoms and small kings in ancient times. This King Lemuel was certainly well before the conquest of the Promised Land, before Israel had its own monarchy, and where we have the kings of Israel, we know where they came from and who they were descended from. This harkens back to a time well before that. And evidently King Lemuel was a man who's, by some mysterious means, had access to awareness of God. We don't know how, but we know that he has his thinking was taken into the scriptures because of you know, what he'll say here, and it's worth hearing as the people of God, even though we can't place him in Israel's history. Randy?
What does Lemuel stand for?
I don't remember. I didn't look it up. The last two letters are God, the word for God, so what something about God. L is would be God. Bob?
Could it be a nickname that Bathsheba gave Solomon?
Could it be a nickname for Solomon? No, probably not. I don't think so.
R.C. Sproul says it's Babylonian.
Well, what does he know? I mean, no. No, I mean, I think that's actually a terrific guess. That's a great guess. No, exactly. No. Yeah. But the thing is, again, so we don't know who he is or where he came from, although he has access to God. The other thing that's striking about this is the honor he is paying, King Lemuel is paying, to his mother. is unusual in the ancient Near East to credit one's mother for shaping a king. You learn to be a king by your father being king. And, you know, the father teaches lessons, and the father makes a man a king, and that sort of thing. But here, this guy very wisely is saying, I am who I am because of my mother, and in large part. And I learned lessons that I wouldn't have learned from my father, most likely, that I did and have learned from my mother, and they're crucial lessons. About. And so the early verses in this chapter are not so much about the noble woman yet, but as what makes a man a noble king. And I just want to take a minute and ask a question. What are the kinds of lessons, and may I guess I'm asking the men in the room, or although if, as women looking on at men learning, your own sons or your people, men you've known, you might want to comment on this too, but what are the lessons that men can learn from women that they're unlikely to learn well from other men? Just thinking out loud. What are the kinds of emphases that, and it's maybe especially your mother, will have contributed to your life that you wouldn't have learned otherwise? Maybe your wife contributes to you. If you have sisters, what have you learned that absent the women in your life you would not have known? Maybe. So put a hand up first, and then we'll get the mic to you. Yeah.
Compassion comes to mind right away.
Compassion, great.
Writing of relationships, no matter whose, if there's a fault, even if it's not yours, still writing the relationships.
So I think that's a great, both of those are great points, actually. But the idea that relationships matter for their own sake, not they're not just utilitarian. Most of the time men are, especially if they're just men in the room, they tend to get competitive, I think. We tend to measure things by accomplishment. Whether or not we have a good relationship, I know the pecking order we stand in, I'm better than you or not as good as you, and I have 10 points, you have 8, or whatever the issues are. You know, men tend to externalize how they relate to one another by what they do. The idea that relationships on their for their own sake are important, you tend to have learned by having a relationship with women if you're a man. It's the women in your life that have taught you that. And the normalizing of if there's a broken relationship, it should be fixed. Or if you know mending or whatever it takes, I think that's Dwayne.
I think because of the God-given roles of men and women, I think that women tend to be probably in their very design more inclined to be selfless, and that's something I think men struggle with a lot. And that's for men, that's something I think we can learn a valuable lesson about.
Dale.
My mother was a school teacher and also a farmer's wife. I grew up on a farm, and I think a farmer's wife has a kind of a unique role to be part of the whole operation of the farm in a lot of ways and give guidance to that and fill in, and that certainly proved to be the case with her.
Oh, that's great. I want to hold that vision for a minute. Dell grew up on a farm. I don't know how many of you did. I did not. But the idea of a, especially a family farm, is much closer to the biblical world than the modern post-industrial revolution world where you live in an urban environment and you work 10 miles over there and recreation occurs 15 miles over this direction and everybody, the home is completely separate from the place where you make a living or have community or and everything's bifurcated. And the world that we're going to enter in Proverbs 31 is a world in which the home was a place of productivity as well as relationship, as well as beauty, as well as all the things that make up life happen kind of near at hand. And so we'll talk a bit more about that when we get there, but it's a good reaction. Someone else has the mic. Yeah.
So I think forgiveness, whatever you do, a woman will... especially moms will always forgive you, and kindly and forever lasting love.
Yeah,
I think that women give out forever lasting love. That man sometimes we need to learn from that how to give that love out, because sometimes for men it's a little bit harder. It can last. could have a shorter lasting time, or but woman, just it's everlasting.
That's great. Great word. Yeah, valuing love over other things. I think that that's a good observation.
I believe that a big difference is that women teach men, or I have been taught, to learn how to listen.
Okay.
Because pretty much I want to get to the bottom line.
Right.
And forget the story. Just what's the point here?
Right.
And being able to listen is an important factor of any relationship, because it shows that you care about the other person when you're taking time to listen to what the person is saying, rather than just racing to what's the end of the story.
Yeah, I cannot tell you how many times something like that lesson has been at the core of marital struggles I've seen as a pastor, my own marriage, where I think I understand what you're saying, let's charge off and do something about it, versus am I really taking the time to listen? You know, and the listening itself is something. It's worth not just the communication that takes place, but the honor that goes along with listening to someone, the appreciation of them, and the. So I do think that's a classic. You know, I want the data. Give me the data, and then we'll act rather than actively listening. And what happens when you actively listen? Okay, well, let's hold some of those thoughts. We're going to jump in and. This Proverbs 31 has two pretty distinct parts to it. And the first one is, we'll start with the first one. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women. Point there is many women. Don't. Dissipate yourself sexually. Not that he.
I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah, not having a woman in your life, not having a right woman, but the idea is, don't be someone who sort of dissipates your life with women as objects or something. Or your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of the afflicted. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. You open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of the destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously. Defend the rights of the poor and needy. So one of the things this mother is doing is making her son a king. And I think that's a great vision for parenting in general, for both sons and daughters. But in this case, it's a mother saying to her son, I believe the best about you. I don't want you to turn out to be less than you might be. Then I want the gifts God has given you to flourish. And I think of you as a king. Now, in this case, he had some station in life. He ruled over a city or something. We don't know how big his kingdom was. But don't be the kind of king who fails in the calling. Don't be someone who dribbles your life away on what isn't worth doing. But the starting point, I think, is kind of worth taking seriously. She talks about this boy. You are my son. You are the son of my womb. You are the son of my vows. Think for a minute about the crisis we have today about parenting and a commitment of parents to children, children born not knowing who their parents are, with a sort of a sketchy relationship to kind of their physical, how they came into the world physically, where parents sort of make their own life the crucial thing, and you know, I'll either have kids or not, I'll pay attention to them or not, it's my career that's most important. The idea that this is someone who is both my physical son, you're the son of my womb, but you're the son who came from the vows made between your father and I, and you are my son, someone with whom the connection is crucial. What does it does this call into question some of the habits of the modern world, you think, and how kids are, you know, they're created in test tubes, they come from who knows where, they may or may not be important, they're abandoned, ignored. Some kids grow up with 15 different sets of adults in their life at some point that are called whatever, father or guardian or something, that no one owns them. How does this comment on some of the realities of the modern world? Does it strike you as worth thinking about? My son, the son of my womb, the son of my vows.
Well, certainly, as you said, the son of my vows, wedding vows, but also the commitment to the relationship and family that that implies, as people who are committed to each other.
Right. And to have that kind of parenting, someone that's put the, you know, from the heart and from a deep place, you are my son.
This is just a comment. We bought a little townhouse in Canada in Christmas 1982, first piece of property, moved in, and there were all these people up and down. Those townhouses all jammed together. And there was a lady two, three doors down, had three kids. There was no male around, older male around. And it turned out all three kids had different fathers. And, yeah, you hear about it now. It was the first time in my life I'd ever run into that. And it just stuck with me. I never spoke to her or anything. I'm just really strange. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess a protected upbringing, or I didn't ask questions. And I'm not sure what to make of it. It was just a comment. It turned out to be fairly common when you met more people, because we just started working a year before. But now it's kind of unremarkable, unfortunately. Yeah. So.
And she has a right to speak into this boy's life because he's in her heart. This, you are my son. There's no backing away from a deep and abiding care for you. Listen to what I have to say because I'm someone who loves you, someone who to whom, you know, on every level you matter to me, and that's not going to change, and so on. And I think that's what gives us a right to speak into our children's life. And you know, there's adopted folks here. You come into a family different ways. We have adopted grandkids. You don't always get to the ideal start in things, but is there someone who will say, you're my son, unless you're a girl, in which case you say, you're my daughter. But, you know, you're the son of vows, of my heart. You matter to me. And now I have something to say. Listen to me. Jim?
Verse 3. Do not give your strength to women. Somebody jumped out at me. 13th chapter of Judges. Uh-huh. The angel of the Lord is telling the mother of Samson what he's going to be like, and watch him. Yeah. And this is a description of Samson.
Yeah, Samson didn't listen much to his mother, unfortunately. And there's a lot of that going around. But so what are the warnings? Let's now, having established kind of the relationship, the mother wants her son to be king. Wants him and to reign in life, we might say, even if you're not formally a king. We live in a democracy. There are no kings. But are you someone who's going to reign in life? Are you someone who's going to live a life of purpose, of value, of contribution, someone who knows who they are, someone who's going to make a difference? Well, the first thing you have to decide is you're not going to dissipate yourself in terms of sexuality and relationships and treat women as sort of stepping stones, objects, tissue paper that gets thrown away when you, you know, after whatever you, I mean, that, and we know already there have been warnings in Proverbs about young men who will be victimized by women who have designs on taking from them, you know, what's valuable. And so the man can be a user of women. There are women who will be users of young men. All of that's out there. And are you going to stand up to it, or are you going to have, you're going to make choices to have, you know, and that we get down in verse 10, an excellent wife who can find. You know, that singleness is honorable, an excellent wife, an excellent marriage is honorable, but dissipation is not. And so she sounds a warning. You've got to make, early on, make choices.
So she's really contrasting the lifestyle of wine, women, and song with you have a higher calling, a higher responsibility,
yeah.
self, fulfillment, indulgence, whatever hedonism is to be contrasted against. As a king, you have such a great impact on so many people.
Right.
You have to be the voice for the mute. In other words,
yeah.
the downtrodden, those who have no champion.
Right.
No one to help right the wrongs in their lives.
That's great. So the point is this is not just a negative statement. Don't drink too much is the next thing. You know, there someone who ruins your life with drugs and booze and sort of avoidance, someone who ruins their life with relationships that are going nowhere and have no you know, don't contribute anything. Because, I'm not just telling you what not to do, because you have a high purpose. That's the whole point. You're a king. God made you for a reason. You have a role to play in his economy, in what he's doing. We know, you know, the New Testament speaks of us as children of the king. We are a royal priesthood. We're here for a good reason, to make a great contribution to the world God made. So we say no to some things in order to say yes to other things, and Randy's bringing those up. What are the? By the way, this is probably not a great verse for the recovery ministry. Give strong drink to the one who's perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. I mean, he's not saying medicate yourself with alcohol. You know, just because your life's tough or you're unhappy or you hit a bump in the road, go get drunk. I mean, he's not saying that, but. Or she's not saying that. The point, I think, is anesthesia exists for extreme sorts of pain. If you're, you know, we put my mother into palliative care at the end of her life. The last few months of her life, she was on hospice. She was in a lot of pain. She knew she was dying. She couldn't communicate anymore. And we didn't hesitate to give her the kind of meds that were going to keep her from suffering. That's kind of what he's saying. He's not just saying, "Hey, you're a little unhappy, or you know, your team didn't win this weekend. Go out and get drunk." That's not the point. It's more there is a place maybe for anesthesia, but it's not for kings in their prime. Not for kings when they have a role to play in the world. So don't dissipate yourself in that regard. And then, what are the positives? What are the what is the calling for royalty in this section? Randy mentioned you speak up for the mute. There's some people that have no voice, and if you have a voice and they don't, take up their cause. What else?
Well, over and over again in Scripture, of course, is the admonition to care for widows and orphans who are, especially in that time, have no ability to speak up for themselves or to take care of themselves. Today, we've added the unborn to that, which was, as far as we know, not much of an issue back when this was written, and yet not able to speak up for themselves at all. And if you're not in control of your faculties, so to speak, if you're dissipated, whether it's sexually or by substance, alcohol, wine, beer, whatever it may be, then you're in no position to be sure that you're going to be able to judge wisely and fairly and to care for those who are desperate. You're more likely, I would say, to be at risk of, "Oh, boy, we had a great party, and everybody's drunk, and my buddy said to me, the king, hey, how about doing this for me?" But the price may have been borne by those who were needy and not able to defend themselves.
Right. If you dissipate yourself at the end of verse 5, you forget what has been decreed. Kings need to remember the stuff everybody else forgets. What's important, what's necessary, what's godly, don't forget. And they pervert justice, that you stop caring about what's right and wrong, and then the mute have no voice, and so on. the rights of open your mouth for the mute and for the rights of those who are destitute, the poor, have no one championing them. And again, it's hard to live during an election season. I think I've been talking about Proverbs and the American electoral system sort of, you know, come into kind of high relief against one another a lot, it seems to me. But you know, and again, I don't know the hearts of everybody, and I don't want to be judgmental, but there's an awful lot of rhetoric for the poor that doesn't have any substance. You talk about the poor only until the votes are cast, and then you ignore them just as quickly as possible. You know, the claims of sort of concern for righteousness exist until I've got your vote. And then I'll dance to the tune of people who gave me the money to get me elected, and on. So, that, you know, both parties, you know, all sides. But the king is supposed to remember what's decreed, what God has said, establish justice, speak up for those who don't have a voice. And again, this is all, by the way, this is the kind of thing you're more apt to learn from your mother than your father. What would the father have taught the king to do? Fight a war? You know, do all of the hard guy stuff that kings have to do. You have to dominate the enemy. You have to build up the military. You have to collect the taxes that run the... But the mother is saying to the king, don't forget, you're not there just to do those things. You're there to honor God in the needs of the downtrodden. The mother has a huge amount of training to establish what a king ought to be. Open your mouth, verse 9. The mute have no voice. You open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. Any other comments before we move on to the noble woman? Yeah.
Well, just a quick one. It was brought to my attention some time ago that every time there's a king mentioned in the Old Testament, the king's mother is also mentioned. So it shows what you're saying is the tremendous influence that a mother, that a woman has on a man, whether good or bad, because there were a lot of bad kings, but right. And there were a lot of good kings, but right. The mother's name was always mentioned.
That's great. Great word. Okay, so I'm sorry. Go over here, John.
Apparently this king was... slated to be a king from probably from birth, and you look at England when there's someone that is born into royalty, how they are nurtured and trained and taught how to be kingly. Yep. Also, when on the verses. 6 and 7 that uses a comparison, I mean, a contrast comparison mm-hmm. of the wino and skid row mm-hmm. type person. Don't be like that mm-hmm. if you're going to be a king.
Great word. Yeah, you figure out it's a huge advantage to children. You know, most of us have raised our kids. We might be going to raise grandkids or be part of that at some point. But to give children early on a sense, you're here for a reason. You have a noble purpose in life. God knows you. He loves you. He attends to you. He's called you into something. You know, get yourself fit and ready for the great things God has for you rather than, you know, you can tell a kid, stop playing video games, and it's only negative. That all the messages are negative, or to say, wait a minute, you know, video games may or may not have their place, but don't forget, you're called to something great. And if kids really believe that, it changes sort of how, well, I'm not going to ruin my life at age 16 because there's so much more to live for, so much more to do. Okay, so an excellent wife. And this is the second part of this, the mother's training has to do with finding and appreciating and being, you know, she's going to hand this guy over to the next woman in his life at some point. And do well in this process, finding the right woman. An excellent wife, who can find? She's far more precious than jewels. Let me just read the rest of it then. By the way, this is, I'm pretty sure this, I didn't re-look it up again, it's in, from some old notes, but this is an acrostic, this series of observations, not an acrostic exactly, but sort of. It's the first line of each of these statements begins with subsequent letters in the Hebrew alphabet. So it's like A, B, C, D. You know, the first line begins with an A, the second with a B, the third with a C. So there's not, in some ways, the logical progression is a little bit jumbled, because the way you would memorize this or remember this is not because, well, if A and B are true, then, you know, A equals B, then and B equals C, then A equals C. It's not a kind of a logical discourse. It's a series of observations, and the way they hang together is because of this, the alphabet connection. So that it might seem like that he's jumping around a little bit, but that would be the reason for it. Verse 11. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and she will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchant and brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands and let her her words praise her in the gates. Well, one of the things that's daunting about this, first of all, and this is, who in the heck can live like this? I mean, wait a minute. Just every possible thing you're due to the, you know, highest degree, and where are you going to find a woman like this? Amen. I mean, and the point is, it's daunting to, I think, for girls, and it has been in the history of the church, to read this and think, I'll never be that. I can't do everything. You know, I can't. Jill Briscoe wrote a book on this chapter, and this is a quote from her book. The Proverbs 31 woman has long stood as the Statue of Liberty at the harbor of the City of Womanhood, welcoming all who flee from being anything less than perfect. But what if I have runs in my stocking? I'm sure they were all right when I left home. Consistently lose one of my husband's socks in the washing machine. Regularly misplace my car in the supermarket parking lot. It's blue, sir. I know it's blue. Is there any hope for me if I dream of writing a book about my small children called From Here to Insanity, and if I'm shaped like a pillow instead of a post? You know, again, the point is not to say that God has any interest in perfection, but I think it is. Well, let me just ask you, what is the point of painting a picture that's so amazing? Why does the mother do this for her son? Any thoughts?
If we just looked at one at a time,
yeah,
and it's like, whatever you do, do the best you can.
Okay, great. Yeah, all of these, not having the weight of every characteristic here, but in each thing, what can I learn from looking at each of these statements individually? That's good. Someone else? Have a comment you want to make? Yeah, Jan?
I think Mom wants her son, it makes me teary, I have three daughters and one son, to be the very best he can be. And to do that, he needs to find his wife to be the best she can be.
That's great.
And maybe help her as the mother-in-law.
Right. There you go.
By keeping her mouth shut and listening.
Keeping her. Okay, Phil, brief comment. Oh.
It conveys values that women ought to strive for rather than, particularly in light of modern day, what society is telling, be beautiful.
Right.
Be young, stay young, be beautiful. Morally, don't worry about too much.
Phil first for a brief comment and then Del.
I think many people learn best by example. And if we don't have a good example, how are we going to do the good things?
Great word. Yes.
Regarding verse 23 about enabling her husband. Her husband is known in the gates, and he sits among the elders of the land, which is kind of an extension of Proverbs 8:34 and 35. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily in my gates, waiting at my doorposts, for he who finds me finds life.
It's interesting. It says that at the end that her words should praise her in the gates as well. That, and it may be because, by the way, this is obviously a world we already said before the Industrial Revolution, before the feminist revolution, when who you were in your family it was sort of more important in some ways than everybody establishing their own individual career. PhD, bank account, and that everybody's autonomous individuals bouncing around. If two autonomous individuals end up in the same house, good for them. But, who you were was just, you lay down your own markers that establish who you are. This text is very comfortable letting this woman be honored because of the honor that happened to her husband, recognizing that she has everything to do with it. And I'm not saying everything about the modern world is a loss. I don't believe that. In fact, most of it isn't. But the idea that you gaining honor by contributing to someone else, in her son or her husband or someone else, is also a crucial biblical value. When one is praised, all are praised. It talks about the gifts of the Spirit. If one is given honor, everyone is honored. And to be comfortable with that, I think, is an important part of being a mature person. And the folks in the gates, and the man, her husband sits in the gates, she is praised there because everybody recognized the contribution she made to him, I think, on some level. Yeah.
Well, this may be a mother who doesn't want to lose a son, so she says, there's nobody good enough for my son.
Yes, there's... And that is terrible advice, obviously, to create something in the next generation where your children can never be happy in their own marriage because you're going to lean on them so hard would be, the worst possible advice. But, yeah, Jackie.
Well, that sounds like my mother, who was a stay-at-home mom, and my father was out working and everything. She had to take care of the three kids, and she did all those things. And nowadays, in the world nowadays, a lot of us, both men and women, work. And I think now the whole thing about both helping each other with these other things like cooking and cleaning and all that kind of stuff, rather than just one person doing it, is more a reality.
Yep.
And in fact, since I work full time, my husband's the one that does a lot of that stuff. So I want to acknowledge him for doing
Amen.
All these wonderful things.
Amen. And that's a great instinct, that anything that's good about me, somebody else built into my life. To make it possible. So, well done, Paul.
I think that all the things that are mentioned here are things that in a family go on throughout life, things that you have to do. And it, in some ways, I think it builds a woman up in her relationship that God created man and woman, and gave them each unique abilities and put them together so that they could have a well-rounded picture of family, of a well-rounded direction of family life. And so a lot of these things here, I think, when the pictures that are made involve a husband also. And so it shows that unique relationship.
Great. Okay, let's divide this up, because, as I said, ideas are a bit interwoven together. They aren't in logical sequence necessarily. There's some bounding around in here. But if we take the first question of who does this wife being described have relationships with? There's a fair number of relationships that are mentioned here. Obviously, a relationship with her husband, a relationship with her children, a relationship with merchants with whom she's dealing in the community, a relationship with the poor, a relationship with the house staff. This is somebody who's has people that work for her, and if you just kind of comb through here and look at the different people with whom she's to relate, what stands out? What interests you? We've talked a bit about the husband, her relationship with her husband, but again, children, co-workers, merchants, people who work for her, the poor in the community. She knows a lot of people. What, anything among those stand out for you? Interest you? Is there a verse in here, or a phrase that you find compelling?
Well, I would say because she fears the Lord, she is a woman who is of integrity, a complete integrity, right, above board, transparent, truthful, loyal, because right, she fears the Lord. She right, does what is right when someone's looking, when no one's looking. Right. She thinks right thoughts, and she speaks right words. She's a truthful, her character, mm-hmm, all through this.
And she's confident. You know, I think integrity, and she's in the community. She's dealing with complex issues. She's buying things. She's creating things. She's, you know, it's back to sort of, you know, Dell's farm life. I mean, if you grew up on a farm, everybody was part of everything on some level. And, you know, how you made your, you know, way through the buying and selling and agreeing and not agreeing and keeping your word and having a vision and taking some risks and doing the right thing and admitting when you failed and all of that stuff. She's not a wallflower that's stuck. She's confident enough to be out in the world doing what she's doing. And everybody sees the same person. Like you said, it's not you're one kind of person in one place and another kind somewhere else. You're the same kind of person everywhere you go. Someone else?
When I think about farm, I know he said he grew up on a farm, and I did too. The parents, they both work together. The kids are right in there working too.
Sure.
I had been married 6 months, and we transitioned from L.A. area and came up here. And, I mean, every day he would go off to work. I didn't see him working. I didn't see what he did.
Right.
Well, he brought home his toolbox. Well, my dad had like a screwdriver and a pliers and a monkey wrench. He brought home his toolbox. I couldn't believe there were so many tools.
Who in the world wants so many tools? Why does the world consist of so many tools?
But I mean, it was just so different in the contrast where I had grown up, where mom and dad worked together all the time, where I had no part
right,
of his work. I didn't understand.
Yeah.
I didn't realize.
Right. That's a great observation. It's clear the children are learning from their mother because she's around, they're around her, and around both parents together. They're around the means of productivity all the time. Again, it's not everything is separated by a bunch of miles, and you know, you can work with people that you don't know anyone in your family. Go to work and spend 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, doing whatever you do. They cannot know one single person in your family, and that would, you know, in these days that would not have been the case, obviously. Let me take ask a couple questions. First of all, what about her interest in the poor? She wants her son, the king, to be concerned for the poor, but she does. He's going to learn it from her. Verse 20. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. She's productive. She's accomplished. She has things to do, but she's not so accomplished that she doesn't know poor people. She does. And so presumably the son that gets born to Lemuel and his wife's marriage, choose a wife that cares about somebody other than your own stuff. And that's really hard to do in the modern world too. So many young families today, everybody's concerned about getting their kid into Harvard and all this helicopter parenting, and there's all this buzzing around doing, and nobody even notices kind of the hurting folks. But not, marry someone that's going to have a heart for the poor. Because you're going to be a king, presumably Lemuel will have to, and his wife will have to encourage their kids to be royal, live a royal life as well. Anybody want to think out loud about that?
I think it comes down to verse 30 where it says she fears the Lord. And I think that's probably the source of all her interactions to those around her.
Amen. Yeah, probably verse 30 is the central thing in this. I mean, if you wanted to boil it down, charm is deceitful, beauty is vain, external attractiveness is not the point, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. And that kind of gathers up everything. Let me observe another relationship, and that is, it talks about her. She has maidens, this woman. Where is that verse? She considered fields and buys food and hands. Yeah, that's right. She provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. And I think one way to translate that here is that there are people who work for her in her vineyard that she just planted, or in her house that needs caring for, or in some extent she. And again, this is very common in rural settings, ancient settings, that you didn't just have your own little nuclear family in your house, but it was a household that included other people, included who knows whomever. And she is the matron of the house, and people work for her, and they are not treated as nobodies either. You take care of your own family, but you also take care of the people that work for you.
Referring back again to verse 23, you could read this section and conclude that she was the one who did everything, and the husband was kicking back out by the gates.
Now, there's a lot to commend that. When you think of it. she's, some of the arguments of, feminist antagonism to the Bible is that it sort of makes women into doormats. They aren't given anything to do, and men have everything, women have nothing. But you could almost wonder if the man is worth anything in this scenario. And she's so accomplished in some way. Any other comments? Paul?
One thread that I see running through both the son and the potential wife of the son is common thread of selfless versus selfish.
Yeah.
So in all those descriptions for both son and potential wife, it's avoid being selfish and focus on being selfless, whether you're working hard to support your family or giving to the poor or sticking up for the rights of the poor and so forth.
Yeah, great word. Well, let's turn from relationships. So there's a number of relationships she has, whether it's in the community, whether it's in the business world, whether it's people that work for her, whether it's her own children, whether it's the poor, whether it's her husband, a series of relationships. There's a whole bunch of accomplishments that are mentioned here, different kinds of things that she's interested in, whether it's doing deals of some kind, whether it's working with her hands, whether it's anticipating the winter's coming and certain things need to happen because of that, whether it's making stuff beautiful, that there's a series of accomplishments that get noticed here. And I'd be interested in if any of them stick out for you. Stuff that she has interest in, she has skills at, she pays attention to. What of the accomplishments in here strike you as interesting? Mary?
Well, my question is, where does the money come from that she has to hire servants, to plant crops, to go out and feed the poor? I mean, her husband must be bringing in income. Mm-hmm. I mean, she can't be covering all these expenses on her own.
So the question is, where does the income come from? We don't know the answer to that. And this is not obviously a desperately poor family, that the mother is raising a king. You know, she assumes that her son is going to raise a king. And so but part of it is, if you had a farm, I mean, the farm itself generates the income that you pay your workers with. So if, you know, you're growing wheat or whatever it is, and when you know, they work in the fields and they help with, you know, store this and so on, the home and the enterprise are sort of intertwined together a bit, maybe part of it. And if you have some land and you sell some and buy some other, the amount you got for this is what you bought the vineyard with, and you plant it. So there's a the home and the business are very well intertwined in some ways, I think. Yeah.
Well, this is a plug for teachers, verse 26. She speaks with wisdom, and faithful instruction is on her tongue. So that's another of her accomplishments.
Yep. She's a teacher.
I was just going to observe in today's environment, sort of something that maps into this is, if you look at the career of Marissa Myers, who was a big hotshot at Google and became CEO at Yahoo, has a lot of pressure on her to try to make Yahoo work, and just announced, I guess a couple of weeks ago, she's going to have twins here shortly. She already had one child, but has announced that she's only going to be off work for a week or two and back.
Nothing, you know, will change.
Nothing will change. It'll all work out. Right. So that's another view of how things work.
We're going to presume that income is not going to be one of the problems she'll have in affording twin care or so.
Another thing I notice here is her looking for wool and flax, and then make clothing. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies belts to tradesmen and so on. She's very knowledgeable in quality and what she purchases and so on. So,
and the combination of utilitarian and beautiful is interesting. You know, it's going to get cold, so people need to have clothing, but they have beautiful clothing, you know, or it's attractive at least, and she sort of doesn't have to compromise one for the other on some level. Yes, you want to say something in the back row too, I think, didn't you?
I was just going to say that she obviously has some financial skills if she's selling the garments that she makes, and maybe some weaving skills and agriculture skills. So, you know, she knows those things. And she's probably bringing in an income from that, too. That's part of the money that comes in. So.
Yeah, that's the impression you get, that she's generating revenue that also blesses other people. She's not just her husband's paycheck. She's not doing this with just her husband's paycheck. I think that's right.
I read in the paper that this Marissa Meyer, whatever her name is, that she did say that her job is the most important thing in her life. So as to who's taking care of her kids.
Jim, the cynicism is just way too deep, Jim.
Isn't it also in that time that other cultures, the woman was not regarded as highly as the Israelites and in that culture, Right.
People who knew God. And Lemuel, we don't know that he's an Israelite. He probably predated Abraham even. So, I mean, but people who had some awareness of God had a much higher view of women than those in the wider culture. And that is one of the things that makes this such a remarkable book, is this is a guy writing not only about a woman, a noble wife, but the wisdom of his mother. He's looking back to his mother as well as forward to his wife, and he's using the voice of a woman, his mother's voice, to talk. That's quite amazing for as ancient as this is, actually. Well, let's last few minutes, let's focus on, we've already looked at this a bit, mentioned it, verses 25 and 26. Strength and dignity are her clothing. She laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. I like the idea that she, by the grace of God, has a very high regard for herself. Strength and dignity are her clothing. There's an enormous amount of freedom in this person to not wonder, what does someone else think of me? Everybody, Scott's message today was on envy and jealousy and how so much of what we do has, how do I compare on some level to other people? She has figured out how to live in the presence of God in a way that doesn't require other people's opinion. And she laughs. There's a joyfulness about her. And I think if you combine those things, if you want to be happily married, son of mine, son of my womb, son of my vow, marry somebody who knows who she is, who receives her sense of identity from the Lord, who is joyful about life, who is kind of sees that however difficult the circumstances are, there's an awful lot to be thankful for, and she gets, and then, as we already mentioned, she's a teacher. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. These great, deep sense of her own approval she can pass on to someone else, and this is good advice for what to look for in a wife.
I like to say that she's comfortable in her skin,
yeah.
And then I don't know if this is a harsh statement, but I've always learned that you can't love others until you have to love yourself before you can really love others. Because I guess that's, you take your focus off yourself then,
right,
if you're comfortable and love yourself. And she definitely does that.
Well, I've been kind of rephrasing that slightly, been more comfortable thinking you've got to be loved in order to love, for sure. But I think letting God love us, yeah, you got to be loved by God and be made, let him make you someone who's not afraid anymore. You know, love casts out fear. You're not afraid anymore. And then you can give love because you've been a recipient of love, I think.
And I don't know how you can be comfortable in your skin without knowing God.
Yeah.
Because
you're always putting yourself up against somebody else, and if somebody's better or you have envy and all these kinds of things.
And the problem is, you know all the stuff that you've hidden from other people too, right? All the crummy stuff about yourself you've hidden. Even if no one else knows it, you know it. You know it. And God knows it. I mean, he's the other person that knows all that stuff. And if he loves you, I mean, if you can be loved even with your warts and failures and bad attitudes and temptations and on and on, that's how you get to be comfortable in your own skin. Somebody knows me to the depth and loves me to the depth, and therefore I'm not going to be afraid of what you think, and I can contribute to other people. I have something to offer, and rather than having to grab everything and hold on to it and, on and on.
I'd just like to connect verse 30 again with verse 10. Verse 30 can apply to any woman at all. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So whether a woman is a wife and a mother actively, but perhaps, or was and is no more, or has been single and never a mother, never a wife, every woman can be a woman who fears the Lord. And such a woman is to be praised. And when it goes back to verse 10, a sample of a woman to be praised is this wife of noble character. And I think even if a woman is not a wife and mother actively at a given point in time, they could still go through this chapter and say, Lord, how can this verse be seen in me at my station in life right now? Mm-hmm. And it might be quite similar, it might be quite different. But if the bottom line goes back to verse 30, let her be praised if she is a woman whose life shows that she fears the Lord.
Amen. I'm not sure if this... go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just want to read a statement I wrote down, Steve, when you taught this once before.
Well, you ought to pick a better...
I have your name beside it.
Sage.
A husband or wife of noble character is not necessarily that way in the beginning. You become that person as you grow together and in your love for each other.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I mean, whether that's... the sentiment is true, wherever it came from. Because I think verse 10 can be misleading. A noble wife who can find... Nobody starts out as a noble wife. If you look for this person, forget it. I mean, you marry someone, and together you become more like something like this. I mean, is the heart for the Lord there? That's kind of the first question.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying is that, you know, there are going to be ups and downs. You have to adjust and learn to live together. And as your love grows and you stick it out, there's also written, God responds to husbands and wives, I understand, do not quit, I will never leave you. I'm sure that came from you, too.
I doubt it. I was quoting someone else. If I know. Well, I think this is a good place to quit. We're going to be, I believe, in Colossians next week with Brother Dolphin back in the saddle. So that'll be good.